Jeremy Courtney is the founder and CEO of Preemptive Love Coalition. It's a first in, last to leave community of peacemakers. I love that. They provide frontline relief and long-term development in Iraq and Syria and other areas of polarizing conflict. Preemptive Love goes where no one else will go. To love the people no one else will love, providing thousands of life-saving surgeries for children, millions of hot meals, fresh water for communities without water, and they help refugees, refugee entrepreneurs rebuild their lives so they don't have to rely on aid. I was having another look at their website this afternoon. They help people into jobs, and my goodness, all that they do is absolutely amazing. And so we are in for a real treat tonight. I want you to put your hands together. Welcome Jeremy Courtney as he comes. Okay, so it's great to have you and your wife here. You've been ministering for the last few days at Stairway Church.
Yes.
For their More conference, which is great. That's where I saw you the other day. So we're on tonight and twice tomorrow. So, but you don't look tired. So
I'm not tired.
You're doing okay.
No.
That's great.
Ready to go.
I Googled Baghdad weather this afternoon, and for the next week, it's going to be 43 or 44 degrees Celsius. So it's, what, about 110.
Very happy to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So for those of us who want to whinge about the cold weather, you know, it's like, I would rather this than 44, yeah? Who would love it if it was 44 degrees right there, just out of interest? Because I know you're out there somewhere. Yes, one, two, three, four. Oh, they're very tentative. It's like, yeah. Okay, so, you know.
That's assuming that there's actually electricity and air conditioning and somewhere to retreat to.
And a swimming pool.
Yeah.
That's it. I like it when it's that hot, when I've got that. When I first heard about you guys, and it's only in the last few months that I actually heard about you and what you're doing over there through Peter McHugh. And he said to me, he said, would you like to have this man, Jeremy Courtney, minister in your church?
And you said, absolutely not.
Yeah, that's right. But then he talked me into it. So here we are. No, and I got online and I looked at what you're doing and some of the things that you've shared at different places like Hillsong. And I thought, my goodness, yes, I want you here to share with us. We have an absolute passion in this church for justice and for what you're doing and helping the marginalized. And so it is a delight to have you here. But I've got to say, when I first heard about you, I'm thinking, my goodness, who is this couple that live in Iraq with two young children? So you have a boy and a girl. What are their names?
Emma is 13 and Micah is 11 almost.
Okay. So were they born in Iraq or in America?
Emma was born in Turkey. Okay. And Micah, we learned of Micah's soon arrival into the world about a week or two after moving to Iraq. But he was actually born in America.
Okay.
So we got the blessing of knowing that we were going to have a new child right around the time we got the blessing of moving into, you know, this new, very hard place to live.
So. Yeah. And how did you get, you know, to Iraq? Like, what was the thing? Did you get writing on the wall or an angel turn up? Like, what would make you move to Iraq?
Well, the big catalytic moment, I guess, in many ways, goes back to September 11th. 2001. We had just been married a couple of months, I guess, at that point. September 10th was my birthday, and so I'm just a couple hours into being, you know, 22 years old, freshly married, no kids, none of this stuff, and we wake up to news that America is under pretty serious terrorist attack. And I mean, that's hard for any country to go through, as other countries have gone through this kind of thing, but there was, I think the world would agree, there was something unique and special in a terrible way about America going through such an orchestrated series of events like that. And it seemed at that moment that world history was changing. And I think now, 17 years on, it does bear out that something really significant happened in that moment. And we found ourselves responding to that moment with much of America now rallying unto itself and, you know, waving the flag ever higher. It turned into a pretty fast conversation about Islam and Muslims and those people over there and why are they like that and why do they hate our way of life and why do they hate our freedoms. And there was a real, I would later come to understand, I think a real myopic sense of trying to analyze what was going on in the world and why things were the way they were. There wasn't a deep introspection about decades of American foreign policy. There wasn't a deep introspection about that which we share in common. There wasn't a deep introspection about the commonalities between Islam and Christianity. It was just a very polarized us versus them kind of thing out of the gate. And that's really good for nationalism. That's really good for patriotism. That's really good for banging the drums of war and getting people to march in step. But the last 17 years or so have shown that it's got a lot of attendant terrible side effects as well. And so I think as we got drawn more and more into that conversation about terrorism and Islam and what does it mean to follow Jesus and what does it mean to be a good American, ultimately we just had to raise our hand and say, we want to try and respond to this somehow. And we weren't enlisting in the war side of the effort, so we enlisted more in the, I think what at that time we would have called the missionary side of the effort. And ultimately raised our hand, went out to be church planters in and among Muslims. And that first moved us to Turkey. So we lived in Turkey for a couple of years. And while living in Turkey and trying to work out our faith and fear and trembling, you know, we became more and more aware of the war in Iraq and what was going on there. Saddam had ultimately been captured and then executed, and right after his execution, we decided to move into Iraq proper. But his execution itself actually set off a whole other series of events and kind of took the war to the next chapter, which was just really a complete debacle. So by the time we arrived in 2006, the war footing and the war effort was really in a bad way. And that meant that people were suffering on a level that hadn't yet been seen. People were being driven from their houses in a way that hadn't yet been seen. And the factionalization of Iraq was getting more and more polarized. And there was just something about the combination of all those events, human suffering, the politics of it all, and our desire to follow Jesus. It just drew us further in. We went very naively. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. Which I think ultimately was a grace from God.
Absolutely. I think we're all beautifully naive, you know, and I think God actually uses our naivety, because if we knew everything, we wouldn't do it. You know, I think how naive I was when I pioneered Bayside, you know, nearly 27 years ago. And, you know, God says, pioneer a church. You never think about all the ramifications and stuff, but not that I'm comparing pioneering a church to moving into a war zone, although there are similarities.
We should talk about those.
We should, shouldn't we? Yeah, over dinner.
Here, right now.
So I'm just thinking, like, how do you even move into a war zone? Like, I didn't think that was possible.
There's a bus.
A bus.
Yeah.
And you just got a bus into Iraq.
There is actually a bus.
Okay.
We came actually by different routes. So I initially traveled overland by taxi and bus. And I think you actually flew in ultimately once we got some of the basics set up, yeah.
It's amazing. And you got two kids and you live in Iraq. What's it like bringing up two young children in a country like that?
So when any of us say or think a country like that, I think we can certainly be forgiven for a certain image of Iraq coming into our mind about what a country like that is, given what kind of access we have to understanding a country like that, a country like Syria, a country like Libya or Iran or Russia for that matter, or North Korea. I mean, here's the headline that is never really going to break above the fold on A1. 30 million people didn't die in Iraq today. You know, that's not a good news headline that's ever going to make its way to us. So, a country like that turned out to be a lot more normal in many ways than we would have anticipated. I mean, when we made the decision to move in, when we got on our respective forms of transportation to move in, we were terrified, and I think for good reason. The country had parts of it that were massively falling apart, that were extremely scary, extremely risky. But sort of lo and behold, once we got there, we also found out that there was a lot of the country that was just functioning. And we just didn't hear about it. We hadn't been hearing about it. So it turns out the town where we chose to settle is a pretty walkabout town. I mean, we've raised our kids there without much ado in many ways over the last 11 years of living in this particular place. Now, 30 minutes away, at times, there's been intense suffering and chaos and fear and war and bombings and all the kinds of things that you might associate. But then 3 hours down the road from that is another great little place to live and raise your kids, and you wouldn't think twice about doing it. And so Iraq is not one thing. Syria is not one thing. Libya is not one thing. I imagine that Australia is not one thing. Melbourne's not one thing. And I think part of our journey has been learning to be more nuanced about how we look at people, how we let these placeholder words like Muslim, Islam, American, soldier, militia, how we let those things define, become the lenses through which we interpret and relate to people. And I think we've tried to dispense with some of those labels and hold them more humbly, and let people define themselves for us rather than letting our labels and expectations define them.
It's very refreshing to hear that. I mean, in Australia on a regular basis, and even this week we saw once again someone, one of our politicians, speaking out and really demonizing certain types of people, including Muslims. It's very easy to talk about people we don't know from a distance in a derogatory way. How have you changed your mind, your thinking regarding Muslims and also refugees, another group of people that are sometimes demonized by the press in Australia as well as in the US?
When shortly after 9/11, we started seeing friends, cousins, people we graduated from high school with increasingly going to the war booth in the mall or the war booth at the conference or the concert and signing up to enlist in the war effort, we fancied ourselves drastically different than them. We were the people of Jesus. We were not going down that path. And so they would go that way to respond to Islam and respond to these terrorist attacks. But we, as for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord and go this way. We were not patriotic in that way. We were not nationalistic in that way. And I think me, maybe even more than Jessica, saw myself in a very different theological stream than that. So we set out to be missionaries. We set out to be church planters. And as we lived that out in a place like Turkey, as we tried to live that out initially in a place like Iraq, I had to come to realize that I had a very profound spiritual encounter in which I found myself face down on the ground crying out to God. We've been faithful with this gospel message, trying to plant churches for years now, and you're not doing anything through me. Why aren't you working through us? Why aren't you accomplishing anything through us? And while face down on the ground praying that prayer, I saw in my mind's eye that I had my fists up to God, screaming, yelling in an aggressive and defensive posture, just looking for a fight. And I heard this word while I'm face down on the ground in prayer that said, "It's because you don't love them, Jeremy." And what I took that to mean is, you love this guy on the other side of the table from you, Muhammad, for who he might be years from now. You love Muhammad, the guy who used to be a Muslim, that you somehow through your agency and your intelligence and your theology and your boldness, you made him Christian and obliterated who he was, obliterated who he used to be, obliterated where he come from, disregarded all that history and that culture and that legacy and that honor and that household. You got rid of it, and his story started new at you, Jeremy. But that's not loving him. That's actually loving you, Jeremy. You love to be right. You love to be thought smart. You love to be thought intelligent. That's all about you. That's not about this guy, Muhammad. It's not about his family. It's not about Fatima. And I, in that course of that spiritual encounter, I realized I set out on the same exact war footing as all those other friends. I was every bit a part of the war effort. I just chose to do it with a different weapon. Because I wanted the obliteration of Islam. I wanted the obliteration of these people who attacked me and everything we stood for. I wanted them gone, and I wanted them wiped out, and I wanted something new completely in their place. I didn't love them for who they were, full stop. And that's not to try and paint all military with a broad brush. That's not to paint all missionaries with a broad brush. That's me. That's where I was. That's what was going on in my life and my heart at that time. And that has since had profound implications on my life and I think how we live. We've learned to be more humble. We've, in that spiritual moment, when the word came, because you don't love them, my fist came down. I saw myself in my mind's eye. My fist came down, my arms open wide, my fists unclenched, and I assumed this humble posture of hospitality. And it was an instantaneous change in my life. Instantaneous. I'm still on the floor in prayer as I see myself undergo that change. And by the time I stand up again in the real world, I was completely different. I walked out of that room and never again, never again in, I don't know what it's been now, 13 some 14 years, I don't believe ever again have I gotten my fists up in theological warfare, to do war with someone, to wipe out who they are and what they care about and where they are at this particular point in their journey. It's all been theological hospitality and welcome and kindness, and I think that's been a big change for me.
We all need an experience like that. It's got to start with acceptance. I was talking to someone this week about it. You know, in AA, before the 12 steps even begin, there's like a 13th step, which is really kind of zero, if you like. And it's acceptance. We accept you just the way you are. And then if you're willing, we'll take you on this journey. And, you know, that's a kind of a word over this church, acceptance, as you well know, where we've just opened our arms to people and say, if you want to come on a journey toward Jesus, you're welcome to do it here. And you know, not everyone will understand that. But it's a great journey, and it's a wonderful invitation for those who actually accept to go on it, you know. What about refugees? Because again, you know, we often hear about refugees. They're referred to as economic refugees, as trying to, you know, get from one country to a better life and so on. But what about people that you've met? And maybe talk about one or two examples of people that you met. They're genuine people that are trying to get to safety and get their family to safety.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it has come, again, with sort of releasing some of those preconceived notions and those cooked-up, canned positions, political positions that were handed to me from the political party that I aligned with before I ever arrived on the scene to actually experience and understand and listen to something for myself. So we did. We landed on the scene. We moved into the neighborhood, and we got to know not refugees. We got to know Sozon. We got to know Riaz. We got to know Marwan. We got to know Awasha. And it was experiencing the pain somewhat vicariously, but walking alongside people in their pain as they were on the run for their lives that I think began to have a profound imprint on us about where we would land. I don't know that I'd ever honestly thought about it. The party had a position. The church I was part of probably had an opinion, but I hadn't ever given it much thought. And so in some ways, there was a set of expectations that I was probably expected to walk in. We were expected to walk in. But in some ways, we, from a true thinking standpoint, we were blank slates waiting to be written upon because we hadn't had any experiences of our own. This woman, Sozon, and a community of people that we met all at the same time is probably one of the most profound experiences for us. Sozon comes from an ethnic group that is also a religion, so it's called an ethno-religious group called the Yazidi people. And there's actually a number of them that have been resettled in Australia over the last couple of years. The Yazidi people were particularly targeted by groups like ISIS, and ISIS in particular, in 2014. ISIS came for them with a vengeance. You probably heard a lot in the church, a lot of churches rightly talked about how ISIS was coming for Christians and how ISIS was marking Christians for persecution and drawing red letter N for Nazarene people on their doors and taking their homes from them and driving them out and threatening them with death. All that was true. And even worse than that was what ISIS did to target Yazidi people. The Christians were given options to get out of town. The Christians were given a head start. The Christians were given a pass on the way out of town to run for their lives. When ISIS came for the Yazidis, they just slaughtered them in mass. They considered them and called them devil worshipers, which they're not. They're monotheists who are in the vein of the Abrahamic religions. They would accept Jesus as a prophet. They did not need to ever be regarded as devil worshipers or fire worshipers, as other people call them, pure out-and-out pagans. But these labels from afar made them such easy targets for groups like ISIS. And so they would come into their village. And documents have since revealed that ISIS had a very targeted plan to go to the Yazidi villages and wipe them out. The men were separated from the women. The women were kidnapped. You can imagine what happened to many of them, thousands and thousands of them. The men, if you had armpit hair, you were considered a man at 12, 11, 13. If you had armpit hair, you were separated over here, and you were slaughtered in mass. And mass killings took place, and men were dumped into graves. Our friend Sozan and a couple of other people in her family were able to get just a second's head start out of town. And that second or two or three often made the difference in life and death. Like a sister or a mom wouldn't have made it, and some of the other family managed to escape. Families were forced to figure out, if the toddler gets left just a little bit toddling behind the rest of the family, do we press on with the rest of the family, or do we dare turn around and try to grab the toddler? And Sozan and her family, with the ones that they were able to grab, were able to escape up a mountain that is like kind of the domineering geographic presence in their region. And they ran up the mountain, or as you might look at it, ISIS sort of treed them up a mountain. So they got trapped up there. ISIS rules the foothills. They're trapped now in this mountain, 47 degree summer sun out there. And for days they get trapped up there, starving, no water, no food, eating whatever grass they can find on the mountaintop. Eventually, some military action takes place and drives ISIS down and cuts a pathway for them to escape. They escape down the mountain out into Syria and end up coming back into Iraq, where they settle right outside of our home, just a short little drive away from our home. Jessica ends up meeting them in their complete and utter desperation and trauma, living in an abandoned shipping container. One of those things that you would pack on the back of a huge boat, now emptied out, gutted, just these steel walls. They're living inside this thing in the hot summer sun. But at least it's not ISIS, right? And that becomes their home for a couple of weeks. And surely ISIS is going to be driven out of this place any day now. And that turns into a couple months. And surely someone's going to come and fix this situation really soon, and we can all go home, and that becomes a couple of quarters. And surely we're going to be able to get back to our village any time now, and that becomes a couple of years. And over the course of these years now, we've just been in daily relationship and friendship with them. And it's gone from handing out food in their early days to then helping give them a hand up so that they're working and creating and making businesses and selling things for themselves, so we don't give them things any longer. They produce things, they make things, and they sell things. And now they're buying for their own kids, and they're putting their kids back in school and paying rent on their own houses and this kind of stuff. And it's been a profound experience to watch the transformation in Sozan's life, in her immediate family's life, and the wider community that we've been able to come around and realize, look, these people are, they're just like us. Some of them were extremely poor. And right beside them, some of them were extremely wealthy. Our friend Marwan and his family, they owned like 10 businesses. They had hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank. And they just couldn't get to the bank in time. And ISIS, they were in their pajamas as many of them ran from their homes. And it did not matter how hard they had worked, how successful they had been, how smart they were. Suddenly, an entire life's worth of work, their mansion, their multiple cars, their gold, the money in the bank, it was all just completely inaccessible, gone and or stolen from them. And they come out of the desert in their pajamas with nothing to their name left. And that's what it took to save their kids' lives. And then they show up, and it just begs the question, how do we treat them? And how do we relate to them? And do we believe them? Do we believe that they were smart enough to have run businesses and cared for their family? And does that affect how we treat them? And the global conversation on immigration right now and refugees and the othering of these people whereby we see them as so fundamentally different from us and so fundamentally threatening to us is I think, you know, it's more ironic in some countries than others. Certainly in America, it's a shame to me, the way that we are often having this conversation. A nation of migrants, a nation of people who committed genocide just to take control of the land that we now control, to turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to those who are escaping genocide, all in the name of the very freedoms that we tout and claim to be our you know, grand claim to authority around the world is a huge shame. And the church itself is really at the heart of the problem in America right now. And as far as I can understand, Australia's not doing much better.
No, we just need a revelation that, you know, some of the first white settlers here were also boat people, you know, before we throw that terminology around too much. You know, and what you're saying is so right. I often ask myself the question, what would I do if I was in the situation of Australia being under attack? You know, I would do everything in my power to get Christy and the kids to a place of safety. And I know that I'm in good company here, you know. And what if the rest of the world demonized us as a group of people and say, well, we're just, you know, we're economic refugees and we just want a better life, and you're just trying to actually save your life? So I love hearing that story. And I guess that's where Preemptive Love comes in. And I love the name, by the way, of your organization, the Preemptive Love Coalition. How did that come about?
Well, legally speaking, America never had any justification for going to war with Iraq. The whole thing was spun up on lies and conveniences and specious sort of claims. And it was, therefore, a preemptive war. It was an attack on another sovereign nation, all in the name of protecting ourselves. And we were living in Iraq by the time I think that I came to that realization that this is not actually a righteous, at least it's not a purely righteous thing that is being undertaken here. Was Saddam Hussein a brutal dictator? Absolutely. And yet somehow the conversation got more complicated once I was on the ground and heard various claims of various people, as it is in Syria today, as it was in Libya and other countries where we might from afar think that the solution is just so simple. And it was in Iraq when I started seeing people from various groups who just had assumed this posture and touted this mantra of shoot first, ask questions later. The militia were doing it, on the Sunni side, on the Shia side, certainly the terrorists live that way, shoot first, blow things up first, worry about the ramifications of it later. But even in the ranks of those who were supposed to be the most humane militaries ever assembled, the British and the Americans, there was soldiers from among those ranks who literally beat their chest saying, shoot first, ask questions later. Kill them all, let God sort it out. Whatever we do, it's better to be judged by 12 jurors than it is to be carried to our grave by 6 pallbearers. And it was a shocking revelation to me that, again, I mean, fundamentally, a lot of us, we're all the same. You can dress us up in official uniforms with military codes of conduct, or you can assemble in gangs and militias, but at the end of the day, we are fundamentally built to want to protect ourselves. And yet the way of Jesus that we had subscribed to and signed up for seemed to be calling us to a different authority system, governmental system, kingdom mindset altogether than the best of governments that we could put in the field, than the best codes of conduct that we could put in the field, the Jesus way seemed to still be calling us to something higher, namely, give ourselves away in love. And so as we heard this shoot first, ask questions later posture being promoted throughout Iraq, we just started to have an honest conversation with one another. Is this as high as we can go? Is this the best we can do as American Christians? Or is there something greater? Is there a deeper yes to following Jesus that we should be committing ourselves to? And we tried to just flip the whole thing upside down and say, what if instead of being a people of preemptive war, what if instead of jumping forward to get you before you do anything to get me, what if we could jump forward to love you before you did anything to love me? What if we could jump forward to bless you before you did anything to hurt me? What if we could actually be a people of preemptive love? Who instead of worrying, what if I bless that person and they turn out to be a terrorist? What if I sit with this person and then I get guilty by association with them? What if my sending church thinks ill of me because I showed a little bit too much welcome to the Muslims instead of a kind of finger-wagging, gospel-preaching, push-them-away approach instead? What if we could love them all and let God sort it out? What if there was something greater to be lived for than just trying to not end up in a box carried to our grave? And so we decided to call ourselves the Preemptive Love Coalition in hopes that we could actually rise to that vision of what it would mean to follow Jesus.
I love that. I think that would be a great statement for any church. Love first, ask questions later. Wouldn't it? Church has changed. What sort of work does PLC do?
You use that phrase, first in, last to leave. That has at times been a very literal thing for us. We have very often in the last 4 years or so since the ISIS takeover and the Syrian civil war, you know, really coming into prominence in many of our consciousness around the world, we have been on the front lines and first into some of these conflict zones as groups like ISIS are being pushed out of Fallujah, Ramadi, Mosul, similar type groups in Aleppo. We have often found ourselves first on the scene with help. Like when bombs are still falling and there's still ISIS snipers one or two streets away sniping at us, we're there with food support or medical support or whatever people are asking for. This street may have just been liberated. That street may still be under ISIS domination. But if we can gain access to you on this street, we're making every effort we can to get to you. And it's been exhilarating. It's been amazing. It's been terrifying. But what we often find is that it would be so easy to then move on from that exhilarating adrenaline rush kind of situation and put it as a notch in the belt, have some video documentation of how we showed up with bombs going off everywhere, and then move on to the next thing. But what we've seen time and time again is that if we don't stay the course on this street, then it becomes an extremely vulnerable place for an ideology to sweep back in and manipulate people to say, look, they said they would show up for you. And sure, they did for a minute, but look, you're still in squalor. There's still bomb marks all over the street. The water system's destroyed. It's been how many years now, and the kids aren't back in school? And so these ISIS-type ideologies start chirping in their ears again, wooing them back. Look, we've changed ISIS, we have. We're going to do it better this time. And we're going to help you kick out the government once and for all. We're going to help you push out the infidels once and for all. And we are the ones who can actually make this right for you. And so we're a last to leave group of peacemakers as well, because if we don't make long-term commitments to people to help them find local solutions to local problems, then the whole thing falls apart. None of this stuff was made overnight. To look aghast at what happened in 2014 with ISIS and go, oh, how did it come to this? We're all so surprised. Where did this come from? And to just wring our hands and act innocent and naive, like, like, as an American, I don't know what the last decades upon decades upon decades of foreign policy have done to contribute to the situation that we're in today. It's disingenuous or just stupid. And I'm not stupid. I know how to read the tea leaves and the history of what's going on. And so I can't, with that knowledge, not then put programs and family practices in place that ensure that we stay the course. We can't just do one-off projects here and there. We have to make long-term commitments as a family, as an organization, as a church, and I believe as entire nations if we want to see change. They are extremely smart, bright, family-loving, God-fearing people. But the burden of what they are living under, made by behemoth countries, contributed to by behemoth countries like America, is more than they could possibly climb out of on their own.
Does the American government or any other government support your work?
Here's what we say. We rely on private money, not political money. Because we have tried too many times to dance with the American government at the promise of drawing down some financial support, believing that it might bless people. And it never goes well. It's just, there's too many strings attached. And this is probably true no matter what the government is, no matter what the political body is. Yeah. It's just, we have different worldviews. These bodies tend to see problems. We see people. We focus on people, not problems. And it's a big difference when you're fundamentally oriented to see terrorism, to see water that doesn't work, to see engineering concerns. You'll get engineered responses. You'll get counterterrorism measures. But when you enter into a place oriented towards seeing people, towards seeing fathers whose dignity has been stripped from them because they couldn't protect their kids from ISIS. And you think about what that does psychologically to that father and what that sets that father up to be vulnerable to this other group who might prey upon his mental state at this point. Now you don't see a terrorism problem or a counterterrorism solution. You see something much more nuanced and complex than that. And so we're wholly oriented towards seeing people. We recruit people, we build up people, and we believe that good people will address the problems in their neighborhoods and in their families and their communities. But it's just not proven to be true that if we orient ourselves toward problems, that it all works out in the end. And so we have not taken government money, in a long way of answering that. We have not taken American government money or any other government money, except Iraqi government money, to help them build up their own people.
It's wonderful. You mentioned Islamic State a few times. Just tell us, like, in our view, probably through our media, ISIS is dwindling or definitely on the way out in Iraq. What is next, do you think, for Iraq as a country? Is it going to be able to pull itself up by the bootstraps, as it were?
Well, for ISIS was something special. ISIS was something unique. ISIS was more brutal, was more savvy, particularly with regard to media and things like that, than Al-Qaeda, who had come before them. But we do well to not overemphasize or overfocus one brand or another. They all are drawing from a particular well, and that well has not run dry. And that well is not simply Islam. That would be a horrible way of looking at it. Islam is 1.6 billion people, many, most of whom don't even know about that well. They don't even know where that well is located. They're not looking to go to that well. They wouldn't dare put their pail down that well. They don't want to drink that sour, bitter water. Yeah. But the well is there. And there are some people who get recruited to it. There are some people who taste that bitter water. And for some reason, whatever else they've been tasting, this somehow now tastes more empowering and energizing than the thing they had. The well is still there. Nusra is drawing from it. Various Al-Qaeda offshoots are drawing from it. Nusra is on the rise in Syria. And you will still see plenty of terror attacks and asymmetric attacks in countries around the world, including Syria and Iraq and Libya and Yemen and things like this. So it's important that we not overemphasize the defeat of any one brand. It's important that we get down into the aquifer where all this stuff actually lives and try to address that at that deep level. If we're not addressing it at the aquifer level, the deepest well from which this is being drawn, then even if you dam up this well, someone's going to figure out how to drill down over there and draw back from the same source again. So that's where we believe in the power of relationship. That's where we believe in the power of this message of love and this countercultural upside down way of living and viewing the world. Iraq is in a far better place than it has been over the last couple of years. Syria, for that matter, is in a far better place than it has been over the last number of years. And they are in better places from very different strategies. You know, the strong man is still in power in Syria. The strong man that was removed, that helped set the conditions that set all this off, is not in power in Iraq. And so there's very divergent kind of foreign policy agendas and things like that that have emerged. Both countries are doing much better than they have been over the last years. But at what cost? Yeah. I mean, Syria is decimated. Iraq, in many places, is decimated. I drove through Syria a couple weeks ago. I cannot tell you how many hours I drove on the road where village after empty village after destroyed village, after decimated village, I didn't see one human. Syria is emptied out in some places. So is there less violence in Syria? Yeah. Why? Because so many of them are gone. And that could give the impression that all the violent people left. That's not what I mean. I mean, to excise the cancer, the patient was killed in the process. Maybe 1 million people in Syria have been killed in this war, and I promise you, most of them were innocent. Yeah. So where do we go from here? I don't know, but that good people have to be empowered to rebuild their communities, and good people have to come alongside them to help it happen. And because the way the world works, it's not going to happen without money. America is making dogmatic pledges about how America is not going to give to the rebuilding of Syria. Okay. Well, you can set your clocks 3 years from Wednesday. We are going to be back in the same exact situation again if we do not somehow contribute globally to the rebuilding of that which has been destroyed. It's just, mark your calendars. They will find their way back to this well because it will somehow end up tasting sweeter than the bitter thing that they've been left with otherwise. Same thing's happening in Yemen right now. So money doesn't solve things, but the absence of money will guarantee that evil perpetuates and wins.
We're going to start moving to a conclusion. I want to ask you a question personally, and then we'll get back to a couple of comments on preemptive love. I believe you're from Texas, is that correct? Not far from the buckle on the Bible Belt.
I wasn't born in Texas, but I got there as fast as I could.
Right. Why?
That's an amazing Texas joke. Texans love it when you say that.
Okay, that's great.
It doesn't work here.
No. you would have to explain that, which is probably like most of the humor they're used to, you know, which apparently I'm told on a regular basis is not funny. But anyway, you were raised in Texas, and you're working, ministering in Iraq, Syria. Has that impacted on your faith or has it developed your faith at all?
You save that one for kind of late in the game. It's had a unspeakably, immeasurably profound impact on my faith. Look, when we orient ourselves, and this is my home, this is where I come from, you are my people. When suburban churches speak the gospel and read passages that were not originated in suburban settings and call people out to go live the way that the Bible in its time and its culture and its place call people to stand up from this place where we are today, where we find ourselves today, and say, go live like that. We do not actually know what we're asking people to go do. And so we were sent out from a pure-hearted, God-fearing, missions-loving, nations-loving suburban church who called us up out of our place, who put their hands on us and commissioned us to go in this post-9/11 world to love Muslims. Amazing. Unfortunately for them and for our relationship, we changed a lot out there in the world in ways that they couldn't metabolize back here from the environment because they never left. They stayed doing the routine. Routine's amazing. Jess and I have a routine in Iraq. But they stayed doing the routine while we went out and faced the blows that they sent us out to face. Their faith was formed in this crucible, and suburban life is a crucible. It has its challenges. And those challenges and those burdens and what she told us about the weight that has caused us to be buckled down, that will form you and that will form a certain kind of faith. And the faith that you have to be out in Syria, to be Syrian, I'm not even talking about me, the faith that you have to endure what's going on in Syria or to endure what's going on in Iraq, that will forge a certain kind of faith. And often those faiths don't look like one another and they don't interface well with one another. And so when that faith, in our case, we serve as these sort of shuttle ambassadors between the two communities, when we bring that faith that has formed us back into these communities, we can be a bitter pill to swallow for some people because it's hard to metabolize that which has formed and shaped in us out there. And honestly, what it creates is a dynamic where people like us try to be more palatable, or suburban churches, and urban churches for that matter, Western faith, whatever it may be often, has a hard time even welcoming people like us in. You're not that way. You welcomed us in, and you knew what you were getting when you did that. But there are places who would look us up online, who would look at the YouTube videos or whatever and go, yeah, we don't want that. And it's like, well, wait a minute. You're the one who sent us out to go become that. And now you don't want to hear what you invested in 15 years ago? So it's affected our faith profoundly in ways that unfortunately make the lessons that we've learned and the message that we so dearly want to bring back home, it's hard to bring it back home. It's often not welcome back home, which is weird because we felt like we were sent out and faithfully did the thing we were asked to do, and now we don't have a home anymore.
So next time you come to Bayside, you can share maybe a message on the faith lessons you've learned that we could benefit from that we don't normally hear about. Sound good?
Thanks.
So that's an invitation, by the way.
Thanks.
No worries. And I get what you're saying. I really understand what you're saying. I think we need to finish up because we're running out of time, but just finally, to apply to our own church community here, how do we live out preemptive love in our own corner of the world?
I would say get a picture of that person, that group, that community, that neighborhood that makes you start to feel really uncomfortable, that you don't understand. You don't understand their position on something. You don't understand how they can think about that thing or that issue or that political construct or that policy, or you don't understand why they are the way they are. You don't understand how they came to the conclusions that they come to, or you. Some of you know who that is in your mind already. And just imagine what it would be like to take one step closer to them. You don't need to accept their position. You don't need to believe what they believe. You don't need to agree with them. But what would it be like to just take one step closer to them? And to do it ideally in a way that is somehow inherently blessing, hospitable, Because if you think they're against you, if you think you don't understand them, there's a pretty high chance that they don't get you, and they think you're against them, and they think they're not welcome with you. And if you could be the one to get your fist down a little bit, if you could be the one to dare open up your posture into a posture of reception and hospitality and kindness, or maybe at times this isn't even the right posture, maybe this is the right posture. What can I offer you? What can I serve you? What can I give you? You're trying to serve me? You stand for something completely different than I stand for. Yeah, here, it's free. Just explain it to me. I'm just here to listen. I'm just here to try and understand. I admit I've been arrogant. I've been distant. I admit I stayed in my little enclave over here because that felt more safe to me. But I'm realizing now I can't understand you, I can't know you, I can't love you if all I see you as is a problem. I have to dare to try and see you as a person. So how do we practice preemptive love? I would say one scary step at a time. And I think all those words are important. One, you don't need to get from here to Syria. That is irrelevant. Syria is not the point. Iraq's not the point. Bombs and look, before these wars ever start in our hands, they start in our hearts. All these wars start somewhere with what we think and what we believe and what we're afraid of before they ever find their ways to our hands. And so we have massive potential to avert conflict and avert war and avert genocide and avert all these kinds of things and bring about the more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible right here by walking right across the street. So one step at a time. One step at a time. You got to move. I know I'm taking time, but I had this image when we were singing, and I'm suddenly forgetting what the lyric that was being repeated was. But I had this image. We were singing something about let your spirit fall fresh on me, or let it come fresh again. And I had this image. Jessica and I were just on a tour of American national parks, and we went to this waterfall that we had heard about was amazing. And I had this image of us going to this waterfall, trekking up the place to the waterfall. The waterfall's over there. We're here. And I had this image of us just standing there singing, let it wash over us, God. Let it just wash over us. The waterfall's over there. The waterfall's not going to move to come to us. And so a lot of us keep standing in the same place saying, oh, Lord, I want something fresh. I want a baptism. I want the torrential downpour of your rain to come on me. Look, if you've been standing in the same place for a long time and you're not getting anything fresh, you might want to move to where the waterfall is. So we got to take a step. We got to move. And sometimes that the waterfall's not that far away. It's really not. It's one step away sometimes. Scary. One scary step at a time. Scary. If it's not scaring you just a little bit, if you can sing some of these songs that we sing in church today and talk about how the grave has no grip on us and I'm not afraid of anything anymore, I would just dare say maybe you're not doing anything. Yeah. I mean, there's theological truth in that. But I'm just telling you, I live scared sometimes. And I actually think it's a pretty decent measure of faith. If the next step in front of you doesn't scare you a little bit, maybe you're not getting any closer to the waterfall.
Wow. I just want to keep listening to you. This is wonderful stuff. I'm going to be chatting with Jeremy tomorrow morning. Interviews are normally different every time. So tomorrow morning might be different than tonight. So if you want to come back, feel free. We'll upload both of Saturday night and our Sunday morning gatherings on Monday. Jeremy, your website, preemptivelove.org.
Org.
O-R-G. Yep. Go on, have a look at what they do. There's some wonderful blogs. I was reading some of your blogs this afternoon, really inspiring stuff. So put your hands together, please, and thank Jeremy, Courtney, and Jessica for being at Bayside Church.